And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we will take a moment to visit the wonderful world of theater, chatting about the Tony Awards, which, as we tape, were last night. Then we will move from an event that just happened to one that is about to happen, Father's Day. Pop culture is packed with dads, and we are ready to talk all about them. As always, we will close the show with what is making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Now, as we have just mentioned, the Tony Awards were in New York last night as we speak, and our Trey Graham was at the Tony Awards. And he is still in New York, which means he is coming to us remotely.
Hey, technology.
From out of town, Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I am the movies editor at NPR.org, and occasionally I arm wrestle my way into getting to cover the Tonys.
That is wonderful. We are so happy to hear your voice, even though it's kind of freaking us out. You're here in spirit, but not in body.
I am the voice in your head.
Well, we're very happy to have you with us. Now, you were present last night in the press room, correct?
I was, in fact, and let me tell you, it is a sweaty, stinky, airless place.
But now about the press room. No, I don't know what I was saying. I don't even know what I was talking about. You were kind enough to join our live blog at Monkey See, but I did understand that at least you got some tiny cheesecakes.
There were tiny cheesecakes. Also, there was Hugh Jackman and his lovely wife.
Oh, did you have some, you know, did you bump into him on purpose a few times? I nearly fell over.
No, I was actually getting up to go get some Diet Coke, and I'm headed for the door, and his gigantic frame fills the door, and I just turned right around and went back to my seat.
Did you get a chance when you bumped into Hugh Jackman to... like rub, like you say, your upper arm against his torso and then not wash that arm so that the next time you saw Linda Holmes, you could brush into her?
No, mostly I took the opportunity to gibber.
Yeah. Okay, so Trey, from your perspective in the press room, what's the big story coming out of the Tony Awards?
The big overarching story is great night for little shows. Shows like Peter and the Starcatcher did pretty well. Once, of course, was the big story of the night. Even the shows that didn't win, the shows that were nominated, came out of the nonprofit theater, and there's shows like Clyburn Park, shows like Once.
So when you say nonprofit theater,
yes,
what are you differentiating there?
Well, Broadway theater is by definition for-profit theater. It's commercial theater. One of the other defining characteristics of a Broadway house is it has to have more than 500 seats.
And I was going to ask you this, actually.
Some of them go up to, you know, almost 2,000 seats, I think, is one of the biggest ones. And they're produced by commercial producers who raise money to put on the show. They typically cost a lot more than nonprofit productions.
And the idea is they're investments
the way, like, a live concert would be an investment.
Absolutely.
Right.
The nonprofit theater movement raises money. They're, you know, .orgs. They raise money from backers and subscribers rather than from producers. And in recent years, there's been a bit of a creep. The nonprofits have begun buying houses on Broadway and producing Broadway shows, even though they're still nonprofits, which creates some tension between the commercial producers and the nonprofit producers. But by and large, the worlds are still fairly clearly divided.
So, Glenn, you had an eye on the Tony Awards, I understood, from Twitter. Is that correct?
Sure, yeah. I can speak to what I don't think Trey can, which is how it looked on television, just as a broadcast. And I have to say that as a broadcast, it paled in comparison even to last year, which I think is a sign of just how beholden the broadcast is to the Broadway season.
Yeah.
Because if you have good shows, you have a good show.
And they weren't as good for TV as that Sutton Foster.
Right, well, let's compare. Okay, so last year we had Sutton Foster and the cast of Anything Goes in an unbelievably tightly choreographed number.
And big.
Big. This year we had Newsies.
Yeah.
Now, I am outside the demographic that gets this show. This looked like not just the SCTV parody of Newsies. It looked like the Mad TV parody.
I'm like 5 years too old, or else I would be right in it. But I'm not right in it. I missed it completely.
Gotta say, though, that show has a cult, which is why it got made.
Right, absolutely.
No,
and it did win for choreography.
Yeah. Last year, we had Daniel Radcliffe showing the world that he can overcome his case of advanced stage 4 Britishness and sing and dance.
Yes.
So he was that guy from that thing doing another thing.
Right.
So that was cool.
And this year you had Matthew Broderick, who is
watching
that guy.
Feet.
There's a cabaret in this city I can recommend to you. Caps you up like electricity when the band is blowing blue. They play nothing classic, oh no, down there. They crave nothing else but the low down there.
If you need a tonic and the need is chronic, if you're in a crisis, my advice is grab a cab and go down. Where the band is playing, where milk and honey flow down, and everyone is saying, "Lord, that's sweet and low down." Busy as a beaver, dance until you totter. Be sure to get the fever, for nothing could be hotter. Sweet and low down.
You know, this is one of the things I actually have a note on my little pad. Matthew Broderick, grow up and start playing senators.
Yeah, well.
Well, it's interesting because, like, you know, Matthew Broderick to me has always been a very appealing actor. I think he's an appealing figure. But when I saw him in that particular excerpt from essentially a Gershwin songbook musical.
This is the Porgy and Bess musical?
No, this is Nice Work If You Can Get It, which is a Gershwin. He is not in Porgy and Bess.
Although I would pay to see that.
Well, you know, I know they played with some of the racial ethnography.
Yeah. Anyway, when I saw him performing in that Gershwin number, I sort of thought, a Gershwin songbook musical is very reliant on the music itself and on the songs itself, and I don't know if that's who I would have.
Yeah, and what they did was they just threw a lot of scantily clad dishy dames around him.
Sure.
Who were just kind of saying, look at us, don't look at the guy in the middle, look at the guy in the middle.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're basically doing what I like to refer to as the full share.
Exactly. Nice. Speaking of, the gayest thing last year was drag queens singing It's Raining Men. The gayest thing this year was an ad for a cruise ship, basically. That was pretty low.
This is true. Although Neil Patrick Harris did kick things off by saying, welcome to the Tonys, or as we like to call it, 50 Shades of Gay.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I gotta say, I think that joke, boy.
Yeah.
If you're making a 50 Shades of Grey joke right now, it's gotta be like top of the line.
He made a Spider-Man joke as well. I think it's time to retire the Spider-Man jokes.
But I think, again, you're sort of faced to deal with, like Glenn said, the plays you're given. And so you've got a sort of, you know, you're touching on all the sort of Broadway, you know, jokes and things that have happened in the last year. I think one of the tricky things about the Tonys is that it's got more than even the Oscars, an advanced case of sort of a salute to the theater.
Right.
It's the same thing where we always talk about at the Oscars, the a salute to the movies, where you just get all these montages of movies. They're trying to sell people on going to plays.
And they have they have an even bigger problem in terms of showing these montages, which is, at least at the Oscars, you have a reasonable chance that a decent number of the people watching have seen a decent number of the performances in the movies. When you are looking at the Tony Awards, the odds are the vast majority of people who are watching have seen maybe some production at some point in their life of maybe two or three of the shows that you're talking about, if you have the right revivals in the mix.
Right.
But other than that, the vast majority of those people have seen nothing. And very often, especially with new things, especially with plays, literally have no idea what they are,
right,
other than title.
Well, and even a lot of the titles are, certainly this year, some sort of reboot of something that's a little bit more cultish, that you can take something that a few people love a lot and turn it into a successful Broadway production, because presumably you're selling a lot fewer tickets than you are to a movie. So a Newsies or a Once, which are fairly small movies, can be very big plays.
Right, and I thought of them all. Once came out pretty well in terms of the song choice and and the performance.
When you're walking on the movies and staring out to sea, as if your skin was soiled. How long do you take before they start digging? If your life was gone,
oh, yeah. I think it was by far the best fit for the ceremony.
Right.
And one thing I want you to talk about, Trey, is the song choice from Follies, because that was a retro pastiche, which was clearly never going to be a breakaway pop hit.
Yeah.
Very interesting choice.
They chose Buddy's Blues from the second act of Follies, from a section that's called Loveland, which is this, as Linda described it, a shared fever dream about how everybody is having a nervous breakdown and how unhappy they are.
I've got those dots. Why don't you love me? Oh, you do. I'll see you later, blues. That long as you ignore me, you're the only thing that matters. Feeling that if I'm good enough for you, you're not good enough. And thank you for the present, but what's wrong with it, stuff? Those don't come any closer, cause you know how much I love you. Feelings. Those tell me that you love me. Oh, you did. I gotta run now. Blues. Margie? She says she really loves me.
I love you.
She says she really cares. She says that I'm her hero.
My hero.
She says I'm perfect, she swears.
You're perfect.
Damn it.
She says that if we parted. She says that she'd be sick. She says she's mine forever. She says, I gotta get out of here quick.
It's a real tour de force for the performer, but it's a very odd song to put on a national broadcast.
Yeah.
You've got a whole slate of other amazing songs to choose from that show, more familiar songs.
Right. And out of context, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Because
right.
If you don't know that he is in the middle of essentially a nervous breakdown, as Trey says, then it just seems to be a silly vaudeville number like something out of a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
Right.
Whereas if you know what's going on, it's actually this incredibly sad, and this comes out in the lyric somewhat, but if you're not kind of really in it, you don't understand that the vaudevillianness of it is
right.
Essentially played for irony.
Yeah,
The kind of brightness is cast against the incredibly dark story, and that's what makes it powerful.
I thought it was a really interesting choice. I mean, it was certainly a nice thing to give Danny Burstein to do. I mean, and especially since he didn't end up winning the Tony for which he was nominated for that role. But if you wanted to choose another number from that show that more people knew, you had Losing My Mind with Bernadette Peters there to sing it.
Right.
You had Broadway Baby and mm-hmm. Linda Lavin there to sing it,
mm-hmm.
Or Jane Howdy Shell, whichever one you want to use.
Right.
There's a gigantic chorus number for all the older leading ladies in that show called The Mirror Number. The actual title of it is Who's That Woman? And it is
yeah.
a showstopper.
But here's the thing that I was wondering. Maybe the fact that there are a lot of older ladies in the show, maybe they were just too tired. Maybe they said, you know what? No.
Or maybe they
the
were,
kid.
You
maybe
think
they
Bernadette
were too
Peters,
expensive.
Do you think Bernadette Peters spends a lot of time saying, I'm too tired?
That's right. I don't want to perform.
Don't put
really,
me on the
don't
Tony.
Don't call attention to me.
Don't call attention. I will say one of the things I really enjoyed from sort of a couple of different perspectives was seeing Patti LuPone and Mandy Patinkin, who have done Sondheim and a bunch of stuff,
sure.
You know, up there really super hamming it up.
Like, oh, yeah.
I mean.
Speaking of hams. you know, I don't think we can
as
let.
As we are.
I don't think we can talk about this night without addressing one thing that happened in the middle of the acceptance speech from Jordan Roth, who is the producer of Clybourne Park, during a very practiced.
Yeah.
Tread softly there. I know that guy, and
okay.
He is the king of Broadway.
Okay.
Don't offend the powerful. Trey just wants you to know.
Yeah.
Right. I don't want you to afflict the comfortable or
yeah.
anything.
Sure. When he said, and then there are those people who step forward and say, open me, change me. These are our audiences. Gross. Can we agree? Gross.
He did take a little ribbing in the press room for
it's
that.
It's almost as if theater people have an inflated sense of self-worth.
Well, here's the thing. I think, you know, so do writers, so I never go down this road.
Right.
I never go down this road.
The record show that Glenn Weldon may once have dated an actor.
Yeah, well.
Well
it was a long, long time
ago. Yeah, but I don't think Glenn Weldon has ever stood up in front of a group of people and said, open me. Change.
Well,
me.
That's really nothing I hear there, is it? Maybe I have. I think I have the chronology wrong, but in my head, that moment filled with self-importance was deflated by Tyler Perry coming out and saying, yeah, this theater thing's pretty easy. I am making bank. I mean, you know that moment?
Well,
he basically said, suck it, Art.
Yeah. He did say that. On the one hand, I do tend to, when they're very, very rehearsed, I do tend to react somewhat negatively because it gives off that feeling of, like, I totally knew I was going
right,
to win.
Sure.
I wrote my speech and practiced it in the mirror because I knew I was going to win. And that kind of puts me off. But at the same time, so does the Audra McDonald Taylor Swift impression
yes.
of,
yeah.
like,
Meryl
me?
Street.
Are you kidding?
What?
When she was, like, the one person who everybody was, and I should say, I love Audra McDonald. That's exactly what I'm saying, is, like, you could choose to look at it either way. Like, if you're too not surprised, then it feels a little off to me. But if you're too surprised, then it also feels a little off to me. So I realize I'm putting people in a
no-win. I think part of it is that both of those extremes involve a certain measure of artifice. Yep. You know, if you act like you expected to win, obviously you have a gigantic ego. But if you're fake modest...
My favorite stage bit of the award show was a bit at the beginning when Neil Patrick Harris was singing about if life were more like the theater, everything would be much better. And at one point he sort of said, he was talking about the use of understudies and people coming on for you.
Right. Oh my
and
God.
All of a sudden, Jesse Tyler Ferguson comes out and is, you know, going to step in for Neil Patrick Harris, right? Which makes a certain amount of sense. He could host the Tonys. That's not a ridiculous idea.
Sure.
And what made that such a good joke was that earlier in the day, he had tweeted to Neil Patrick Harris, if you need it, I could always fill in for you. And everybody sort of goes, har, 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 because you just think he's being funny. Like, I'm excited. You're doing the Tonys. I wish I were doing the Tonys. Congratulations, buddy. All that stuff. And then this joke kind of wonderfully pays off when all of a sudden he comes rushing onto the stage like, I'm here. I could fill in for you. And you only really get that if you follow them on Twitter.
A multimedia
joke. Which is kind of cool. And I love that kind of joke where there's a little bit of extra setup for people who happen to pay more attention.
So it was very funny. I saw him needling people today, too, because apparently he took some flack from people who thought it was tacky of him to tweet that. So today he was saying, all right, all you people who were giving me crap yesterday.
Now you understand what
now
it was.
You get it.
Now you get what it was for. Yeah. So I did enjoy that quite a lot. And I always enjoy the Tonys. And, you know, it's sort of the blessing and the curse, as Glenn was saying, that they are very beholden to what shows there are because they show so much. You see the number from Newsies, which, again, did not do much for me.
How about that number from Ghost?
Oh, boy. That was definitely the Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark thing of this year.
Yeah.
You chose that song? Really?
But it's also one where it was a pretty radically different, right, from the actual stage production.
We did hear some of that. I haven't seen Ghost, but we did hear some of that today from people who had seen it, saying that they had spliced together several little bits and perhaps even added in a bit of a song that that's not actually in the show.
The performance from Jesus Christ Superstar by the new Judas, introduced
and
by...
And his pants.
Yeah, introduced by Ben Vereen, the old Judas, who I was happy to see.
Yeah.
It was interesting to me how not updated... That was. It felt so 70s. And that show always feels 70s.
Sure, but I mean, the arrangement sounded exactly the same.
It really did.
As the cast album from 1970, whatever.
It really did. To me, it did. That was quite a pair of pants.
Not flattering.
And boots.
Yeah.
Oh, the blue boots. Wow.
Yeah. I actually liked the blue boots.
It was a pretty Jeezy year getting up here.
It was, in fact.
Had Godspell. Had Godspell. Jesus Christ Superstar. Yeah.
Yeah. And Leap of Faith.
Did you just use the adjective Jeezy?
I did.
Anyway.
We got nothing.
I was going to say, I got nowhere to go with that.
Now, ratings for this telecast were down quite a bit.
They were down. And, you know, honestly...
Is that Book of Mormon not being there, or is that...
Probably partly. It could be partly Book of Mormon. It could be partly just general. As Trey said, year of small shows. Yeah. You know, not necessarily one big giant. Everybody wants to see the performance from How to Succeed in Business or whatever.
Right. Now, when you say small shows, I mean, you're talking... Obviously, you were talking before about nonprofit theaters, but... Also, wasn't it small from a standpoint of a lot of these things started out staged off Broadway?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that's often true. That's a
fairly standard thing. It's just...
It's not unusual, I would say, Trey.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Clyburn Park, which won the Pulitzer last year and just won the Tony last night, had been staged in Chicago and at Off-Broadway Theater here in New York.
In backwaters
twice,
like Chicago.
and twice in Washington, D.C. It was such a hit the first time that they brought it back the next summer. So when they're giving it a Tony for being the best new play, they're giving it a Tony for being the best new play on Broadway this year.
Right.
Which is, you know, sort of interesting when we go back to that observation we made earlier about how audiences are largely unfamiliar with this stuff. In this case, maybe a little bit less so.
Right. Obviously, some of these things have toured around a fair amount because Trey and I saw this production of Follies actually before it was on Broadway.
Right,
and a little bit of cast fiddling, but not too much.
Well, it just seems like it's obviously sort of a natural disadvantage that the Tonys are under is that because so many of these things are incredibly New York-centric, and you don't necessarily, obviously Neil Patrick Harris is a huge star, but a Linda Lavin and a Judith Light are not at the, you know, are not
there,
at the
pinnacle. A lot of the theater people
of nationwide acclaim.
Oh, which is totally why they, you know, bus in the Josh Grobins and the Nick Jonas
Tyler
and
Perry.
Whoever.
It's a weird bus.
I did want to point out that even though it was not a gigantic television audience, it did win the evening. It had the highest ratings of anything that night.
Yeah. We lost a good chunk of the live blog audience when they went off to watch the Mad Men season finale. I just watched the number of people watching the live blog was like, because, you know, our people, they watch a little Mad Men.
It's a good thing it wasn't opposite Downton Abbey.
Yeah, at any rate, glad that you enjoyed it out there in New York, Trey. For all of you, if you enjoyed the Tonys or did not enjoy the Tonys or want to talk to us about theater, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH, where there are now 10,000 of you.
Yep. We opened you. Woo-hoo. We changed you.
We opened you. God. Or you can find us on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. So coming up this weekend.
It's my day. It's the day that everybody gets together and celebrates me. And oh, yeah. And to a lesser
extent.
Oh, you
mean Stephen Appreciation Day?
No, it's they celebrate me and to a lesser extent their own fathers.
Oh, I see.
It is Father's Day on this Sunday, June 17th.
Father's Day coming up June 17th.
Stephen's so you're looking forward to a new tie?
Perhaps a mug.
Little aftershave.
Aftershave.
Soap on a rope.
Constantly dousing myself in aftershave.
Little aqua velva. Anyway, so, okay. Father's Day is a good occasion to consider, we think.
Fathers.
Fathers. There are, in fact, fathers all around pop culture. So, Trey, from your position in New York, are they different in New York? Fathers?
Fathers? Well, the most prominent father in New York right now, of course, is Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman.
Very true.
Played by your buddy Philip Seymour Hoffman, who did not win last night.
That is true.
And I like to think back about Willie Loman on Father's Day because it makes me awfully glad to have the father I have.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about Willie Loman and his boys.
Sure thing. He is the tragic hero of Death of a Salesman. He's a guy who's, you know, managed to raise a family as a traveling salesman back in the, what, 30s?
Salesman, I get it.
Yeah, right? And his career is sort of drawing to a close, and his employer has less use for him these days. And the play is all about discovering the limits of his resourcefulness and the limits of his morality. And as his children discover that their father has feet of clay, his wife sort of comes around and, as has been the case before, gives him something to lean on, but also tells the kids that, you know, what his value really has been. It's an amazing play if you haven't seen it. I shouldn't be trying to introduce Death of a Salesman to people because it's not like it's an obscure thing, but it is an astonishing piece of work.
What kind of father would you classify him as being?
He's a terrible father.
I tuned out. You're not talking about me, are you?
What you're describing is sort of a somewhat noble, hardworking man.
He thinks of himself as a noble, hardworking man, but in fact, he's done things that aren't so noble, and he's raised his children to believe about a way of working in the world that doesn't really hold water.
Mm-hmm.
You begin to see, as the play draws toward its conclusion, what effect that's going to have on them as they move into their roles as you know, fathers and spouses.
And
it's really devastating.
Yeah.
They should really call it Death of a Salesman, spoiler alert, because
he dies?
The one thing that is kind of magnificent about the play is how much you root for him despite the sordid things you learn about him. The phrase you'll hear when people talk, even if people who don't know Death of a Salesman very well, will probably recognize the phrase, attention must be paid. And that comes from this magnificent speech that the wife gives to the sons when they're busy running him down. And it's one of the great turning points of the play, and it's absolutely shattering when it's done right.
That's a very sad note on which to open a salute to Father. Stephen, do you have anything?
Save us, Stephen.
Do you have anything sunnier?
We talked.
Do you believe in fathers? I don't know.
Yeah, I generally am pro fathers.
Gotcha.
But, you know, we talked, I think it was just last week, about the taxonomies of aliens and sort of the taxonomy of the way aliens are portrayed in popular culture.
Sure.
There's also taxonomy of dads in popular culture. The problem is it really tends to boil down to there are fathers who are good and there are fathers who are bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's very little...
Somewhat true of mothers as well, I would say.
No, I only pay attention to the portrayal of fathers for some reason. You don't necessarily get a lot of really rich kind of in-between day-to-day struggling of dads who are sort of present and there and trying, but are not necessarily inherently noble.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there are exceptions, but, you know, as a dad, I love, for example... The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge, huge Simpsons fan. But there's an awful lot of that sort of Homer Simpson as the hapless oaf has kind of bled into a lot of popular culture to where Dad is sort of viewed, you know, as a dullard who can barely find his own zipper.
Well, from what I hear, it's certainly affected your performance as a dad.
Right. Well, I think, we joke about it, but at the same time, I think it's very easy as a father to sort of take on kind of a self-deprecating approach to your own parenthood through the lens of all these jokes. About 40% of my vocabulary comes from The Simpsons, and so it's very easy when talking about parenting to sort of take on the Homer Simpson role.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right that you basically get your well-intended but often bumbling dads,
right,
like your Tim Allen dad. Mm-hmm. I actually think of that as the Tim Allen dad more than the Homer Simpson dad, because I think you see that repeated again and again and again throughout the culture as well. And I'm not in any way suggesting that Tim Allen was the first one.
At the same time, Homer Simpson is more of a negligent arm of that.
Right. The home improvement dad thing could be negligent as well. He was not quite as dumb. But also, the flip side of the hapless bumbling dad is the canonization of the dad who does anything, which is sort of the Full House dad.
Sure.
Like, they make breakfast. They're the best guys in the world. Like,
you got it, dude.
Yeah, exactly.
Patting dumb old dad on the head for trying.
Well, not even that. We're getting a little bit here into pop culture ideas, but also real ideas.
Absolutely.
This is sort of the dad is babysitting thing, mm-hmm, which has this double kind of idea.
Ask me how I feel about that.
But it has kind of this double-edged idea of, on the one hand, it's very insulting to the dad because it suggests he's not, parenting. He's substituting for parenting. But at the same time, it's also kind of like, that's so great of him. Like, mm-hmm, that's so special and awesome of him that he, you will hear that used in people who say, like, your husband is so nice, he babysits. So it's kind of like there's a dual, do you know what I mean? There's mm-hmm a dual.
Well, and which really
it sort
is not
of hoses everybody.
Yeah, and it's not that different from going to a career woman who is also a mother,
right,
and saying, wow, you have such an impressive career. Mm-hmm. How I can't believe it.
Of course. And so what I'm saying about the pop culture thing is that, let's say your Uncle Jesse, who's not technically a dad, but it plays the role of one of the three dads in My Three Dads, a.k.a. Full House. Your Uncle Jesse character does not have to do a whole lot other than play in a band and let them sing into the microphone to have them be like, he's like the best parent ever. Right? Because they've sort of lowered expectations so much in some of these shows for, like, what dads are supposed to be like. First of all, it takes two of them to change a diaper in the pilot, but bygones. but once you get past that, they're sort of like anything they do is sort of treated as, like, miraculous, which on the one hand sort of gives them both simultaneously too much and too little credit.
Yeah.
So you sort of get that. And on the other hand, like you say, you also have kind of the great dad, the Walton,
sure,
dad, the Mr. the Pa Ingalls.
Right. Well, and just about any single dad on television and in movies. You know, I think of, like, the Tom Hanks in Sleepless in Seattle,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
the
mm-hmm,
the Steve Carell and Dan in real life. Well, Steve Carell and Dan in real life is a little bit more nuanced and a little more...
He's a little more at loose ends at times.
One show that I think threaded the needle pretty nicely, on the surface it seems like it's going to be Doofy Dad, but Dan Connor in Roseanne.
Oh yeah.
Had a really nice,
one of the most nuanced dad characters on
TV. He's a very good dad. One of the things I always really liked about that show was, and they actually brought it out with both parents, but I always thought it was very interesting that those parents had such specific relationships with those two girls. You know, the dad's relationship with Becky was very different from the dad's relationship with Darlene, which mm-hmm is different from the mom's with the one and the mom's with the other. So they gave them an individual, as opposed to it being kind of like, this is how the dad feels about the kids, which is
right,
what you see on a lot of shows with parents in general. And one of the things I love about the portrayal in Roseanne is that it was always, his relationship with Darlene always had an ease that his relationship with Becky did not have, whereas Roseanne's relationship with Darlene had a friction that her relationship with Becky didn't have because they were so, in some ways, so similar. I loved the individuality that they brought to those parental relationships, which often gets cut out of, I would say, especially dads on TV and in movies.
Uh-huh.
And of course, there is Eric Taylor of Friday Night Lights,
sure,
perhaps uh-huh the greatest dad.
Uh-huh. Well, he's one that jumps immediately to mind. Same with Bill Cosby in The Cosby Show.
Yes.
Who's a very classically nurturing,
kind
of leans back and is
didn't
wise
have a lot of layers, that guy.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about the Cosby Show, and this is something that I read about in the Warren Littlefield book that I keep talking about the must-see TV era, is that although he was a very loving, very nurturing dad, one of the things that they found that audiences really responded to about Bill Cosby, and I would say also about Claire Huxtable as well, was that they were also very tough with their kids in a certain way. And there's a story that's told about the pilot. I don't know if you remember the, it's not the pilot, I don't think. I think it's an early episode where Theo gets these bad grades and then his dad comes and talks to him. And Theo gives this big speech about how maybe I'm not going to be a doctor or a lawyer, but you can still love me because I'm your son. And then they tell in the book the story about how the audience applauds, you know, as sitcom audiences were wont to do, applauds this lovely speech from Theo about you should love me just because maybe I'm not going to be, you know. And then Bill Cosby basically says, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. You're going to do your work and you're going to, you know, because I say so. Then the rest of the audience, the other part of the audience, explodes with happiness at that because they felt like sitcom parents had gone too far
right.
toward
nurturing, everything right. is okay. You're
Everybody
fine.
Loves each other and parents are just constantly saying you're fine the way you are and that kind of stuff, which that there was this very enthusiastic response to having Cliff Huxtable say, you're going to do your schoolwork, you're going to improve your grades, you're going to clean up your room, and it's because I say so. And a lot of people reacted with a certain amount of relief to that. So, Glenn Weldon, other thoughts?
Well, there's a 1975 novel by Donald Bartlemy called The Dead Father. Donald Bartlemy...
That is also an archetype.
Yeah. Donald Bartlemy was one of the premier short story writers of the 70s and 80s. Didn't a week go by where he wasn't in The New Yorker or someplace like mm-hmm. that. A weird writer. A brilliant writer. A guy who deals in absurdism, and he's a satirist. He's an ironist. He's known for his short stories, but... And I'm going to explain the plot of The Dead Father to you, but you should understand that when it's Bartlemy, the plot isn't what it's about.
Right.
There is a mile-tall father figure, a king, who is half alive, half dead, part mechanical, who is being dragged across the countryside of his kingdom on a cable by his offspring. Mm-hmm. Weird stuff happens. That's pretty much the plot of the novel. I read Bartlemy too soon, because he's a guy who's trying to explode the short story form, explode fiction, and do new things with it. I read him before I read The People Who Master the Short Story. I read him before I read Chekhov. I read him before I read Alice Munro. People mm-hmm. are just telling good stories. I was trying to be a scientist at the time. I was in college, and I was trying to get my hands on any fiction I could because I needed to get my brain out of chemical oceanography because that was not a good place to be. So I learned all the wrong lessons from him. I learned about wordplay and wit and pyrotechnics and look how crazy and wonderful I can write. I didn't learn that that kind of stuff has to grow out of character. So consequently, I started writing, and I've talked to a lot of my friends of my age, and there's a generation of us who started out aping Donald Bartlemy directly. I started sending out these glib, clever, as Mo Sezlak would say, weird for the sake of weird, stories, and, you know, they started to get published. Not because the stories themselves were any damn good, because they were resolutely not, but because it's a numbers game. You send out enough stories, you know, eventually stuff gets published, so whether it's 1 in 10 or 1 in 20, and I was pumping out lots of short stories. There's less literary magazines today. It'd probably be harder today, but, sure. I mean, you just got to stick with it. So my dad, you know, he was very proud of his sons, didn't understand why he would be proud of his sons, but he was just resolutely proud. He's one of those guys. Wanted to read one of my stories. I don't remember. I mean, I'm sure I had a very snotty reaction. I'm sure I was like, oh, well, it's not really your thing. Because here's a guy who, you know, he never graduated from high school. He had to work to support the family. I never saw him reading for pleasure a day in his life. Magazines, books, just didn't read. He wasn't that guy. So I forget what story I handed him. I think it was one where the mailbox eats people, you know, whatever. So some glib piece of crap like that. And, you know, he tried. This is why he's a good guy. He really tried to connect with it and, you know, it just was outside of his grasp. So he kind of looked up at me with a pained expression on his face and he said to me, so if anything can happen, what's the point? And it wasn't like a angry, what's the point?
Right.
Yeah, you're no son of mine. That wasn't that.
I reject your literature.
It was, if anything can happen in this story, why should I care? That's kind of what he was saying. And I don't remember my reaction. I think I probably said something like, it's postmodernism, father. You know, I took my giant lolly and my sailor suit and I stormed off. I bet that's what happened. All available evidence would indicate that that's what happened. But I proceeded to ignore that. Now, since then, I have gone to many academies of higher learning. I have. I went to the writers. Iowa Writers Workshop. I don't know if I've mentioned that on this show. I have done fellowships. I've studied under some of the finest writers in the land. And if anything can happen, what's the point? Is the single best piece of writing advice I have ever gotten, ever will get. Because what he's saying essentially is, you create a story. And you need to put a frame around it. You need to set the stakes right away to get us to care. Yeah. You need to establish the rules.
Parameters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's about parameters. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. And it has to be about something. It has to reflect the emotion or the character. It has to grow out of the character somehow. And if it's just about you showing off, being all these little dazzling things, it's an empty exercise.
If you assume that there has to be a certain amount of tension or conflict to make a story work, then there can't be tension or conflict unless there's some kind of limitation.
Yeah. Right.
Not to push against in the sense of fighting, and some of them are much, you know, quieter and more internal than that. But unless there is some opposing force, then you kind of don't have a story. I agree with that. Whether it's the opposing force of, like, nature or other people or your own limitations or whatever.
Well, and one of the worst things that you see in amateurish writing is the sort of, you know, and then the curtain was thrown open, and if you don't impose, like you were saying, sort of rules and restrictions on things, you know, I often say about writing that it really helps to have a bunch of incredibly strict, even something as nuts and bolts as, like, very strict grammatical rules that you have to write around. And when you have to write around something, it forces you to analyze the way your words fall together.
Right.
And I think that the same is true on a larger scale.
Yeah. So what we've learned from this segment is that
Glenn's father is smarter
than you. Glenn's father was a genius.
Two things. A, thumbs up, Don Weldon. You're a good egg, and I miss you. And second thing is, The Dead Father by Donald Bartlemy is a great book you should read.
Excellent. Wonderful. And I should say, my dad is also a good egg, and I will be calling him on Father's Day.
Well, my my father, like Glenn's, has passed away, but he set the framework. He read an unbelievably intensely large amount, would read books a day kind of thing. And that really did a nice job of sort of setting a standard that I could rebel against.
Well done.
That is wonderful. And we hope that all of you will come and talk to us about your favorite dads and your taxonomy of dads. We'd be happy to take your suggestions on setting up the ultimate taxonomy of pop culture dads.
You also have to include dads who throw the cell phone at the end of the movie.
Stephen has this thing about disposing of cell phones in a fit of anger. Well, and that, of course, as always, brings us to our final segment of the show. What is making us happy this week? Trey Graham from New York, what's making you happy this week?
Well, in addition to rubbing elbows with Hugh Jackman, I got to meet two of my favorite theater bloggers. They go by the handles Lucky and the Mick. They run a theater blog called The Craptacular, which is a blog name that I probably couldn't say on the air at NPR. So I'm glad that that we have this little podcast.
Sure.
They are bawdy and funny and rowdy dames, and I am totally going to have a drink with them later this week. I encourage you to visit thecraptacular.com and read their list of 12 things about the 2012 Tony Awards, because it is funny. The other thing that's making me happy is that I'm going to spend the rest of this week in New York seeing Book of Mormon and Porgy and Bess, and a show that I can only refer to as the cockfight play, because its actual title is probably too vulgar even for this podcast.
Gotcha.
And finally, what's making me happy this week is at the end of the week, I'm staying through Monday morning. Sunday night, I am going to an annual fundraiser called Broadway Bears, which is exactly what it sounds like, a burlesque starring almost every chorus boy and chorus girl in New York City. It's a gigantic fundraiser for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. If you follow me on Twitter, or if you happen to be at Broadway Bears and you see me, by all means, ask me how I'm doing around 11:30 on Sunday night.
I think I can guess.
Say it like this. How are you doing? Say it exactly like that. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
In keeping with the Father's Day theme, there's a 1988 album called What Up, Dog? By the band Was Not Was. And so this album includes the song Walk the Dinosaur, but don't hold that against it. It's got two great spoken word things. One is called Earth to Doris, which is very funny. But the thing I want to talk about is a weird little song called Dad, I'm in Jail.
Sure.
It's basically just a bunch of dissonant music while a guy's voice is heard over top screaming, basically, "Hello, Dad, I'm in jail. Hello, Dad, I'm calling you from jail. Say hi to Mom from jail."
I'm in jail now. I'm in jail. I like it here. It's nice. I
artist Christoph Simon did an animation to this song that was part of, you remember MTV's Liquid Television?
I do.
It was part of that. It's great. It's just great. Happy birthday from jail.
What brought this into your life?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Probably owning a copy of that album because yeah. Glenn was a big fan of Walk the Dinosaur.
I was a big fan of Walk the Dinosaur.
Being in jail. Was it that you were in jail?
God, it was so good.
All right. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, Linda, I think you can guess what's making me happy. It may be the same thing that's making you happy. And it starts with the fact that over this past weekend, our little pop culture happy hour has surpassed 10,000 fans on Facebook, as we acknowledged in the beginning of this this episode. Like a lot of modest projects, we are an engine that runs on enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. Having our happy little band of people is an endless source of delight. In fact, one of our happy little band of people has launched a website that some of you may be aware of called pchh-deep-cuts.com. .tumblr.com, in which
she actually calls it Pop Culture Happy Hour liner notes.
That's right. Well, I was giving the URL.
Right, that's
for those
the URL, are, though.
Okay, Crystal Atencio, I think it's fair to say, fan of the show.
From the Philippines,
has been painstakingly going back and annotating old episodes of our Humble.
It's so cool.
God, it's awesome.
It's something that we just do not in any way have the person power to do. It's so lovely to have somebody do it for us. And she went back and found, you know, not just links to the stuff that we talked about, which is all in there, but also stuff like, you know, the first time this is mentioned, the first time this is like where running jokes originated, yeah. which is like really kind of a nice thing for people who picked up the show after we all started acting like people knew what we were talking about when they didn't.
That kind of stuff really does help perpetuate the show. Last thing, I do talk about this every year, but with Father's Day coming up, it's one more chance to tell people to check out the song Father's Day by the band Guy's Night. Mm-hmm. That's G-U-Y-Z-N-I-T-E.
That time of year again.
It is that time of year again. Every Father's Day, I talk about how much I love this song because it is so spectacularly great.
We will once again give you a link to it in the blog post.
Send it to your dads.
Send it to your dads. Very good. Well, that is certainly one of the things that is making me happy this week, but it is not the only thing that is making me happy this week. Also making me happy this week is Bunheads, a show premiering on ABC Family, and you'll have plenty of chances to check it out. It stars Sutton Foster, who we have already mentioned, who is a gigantic song and dance Broadway star, and she's just lovely in it. It is from the creator of the Gilmore Girls. If you liked Gilmore Girls, this is very similar in tone, very similar in style, and the pilot is delightful. I was really pleasantly surprised. It's been a while since they served up kind of something fizzy and fun and kind of pleasant and kind of affable. Good television has gotten so aggressive and depressing that, you know, something kind of sunny and fun was very welcome. So Bunheads. Also, next week I will be at Silver Docks once again. As you all may remember, this is the documentary festival in Silver Spring that I attended last year, and it was great, great fun. So I'm extremely excited about returning to Silver Docks. And finally, I assume that you all have now seen the auto-tuned Mr. Rogers that PBS put up last week. But if you haven't, we will provide a link to it because it made me very happy. It is something that I think that NPR has done sometimes to great effect and that I'm happy to see PBS do, just to really sort of embrace the fun you can have with your own stuff and your own content and the people who really like it and care about it enough to fool around with it. I just found it a delightful little project. And they were taking Twitter suggestions as to what they should do next, like what they should remix next.
Nice.
And I had suggested Ken Burns, you know. not necessarily just Ken Burns himself, but like Ken Burns specials. So like you would get the guy reading the letter and it would be like,
right, the letter,
I'm
letter
afraid
from
of the Battle
Baloo.
Of Gettysburg, 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 Gettysburg. I think it will be very, very moving. And so
yeah, a fitting tribute to the 600,000 lives lost in the Civil War.
Too soon.
So if by chance there's anyone who listens to the podcast who you know, maybe knows anyone at PBS, who knows whether there is such a person. But if there were, I would say, you know, Ken Burns.
To remix the entire Civil War documentary.
Battle of Gettysburg. That's my idea, is Civil War Battle of Gettysburg. So that's what's making me happy, is contemplating the great things that PBS can do with its archives in the future. I don't think this is that crazy of an idea.
No, make it happen, people.
I think it could absolutely happen. And that brings us to the end of our show. Speaking of things that can happen, you can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. Trey will be back from New York, and you can follow him until then and after that at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow our esteemed and very helpful producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which we listen to every week and which we know that you like, and we want to say a special thanks this week to Eleanor Kagan in New York, who helped us with the production end while Trey is holed up in the New York Bureau. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Oh, yeah.
Good luck to you, Trey, getting home from New York.
Thank you, ma'am.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.